I am Portier Chim, and I was a New Voices Fellow at Cambodian Community Development, where I ran a project called the Cambodian American Project for Empowerment. And I actually met Andrew through my work there. He had come in to volunteer with our agency to do some community service, and I was his immediate supervisor. And when he came to us, you know, we ended up having him come in a few hours a week to do administrative stuff, but we quickly realized, you know, that he was very articulate and talented, and we had him start working with youth, and we actually, ironically enough, got him involved with our citizenship program and naturalization services, and he actually worked with a number of our seniors as well. Right. Well, the Cambodian American Project for Empowerment is something that I created as part of my fellowship, which was directed towards organizing and advocacy around issues that impacted Cambodian Americans, specifically because my background is in immigration law, around the detention and deportation of Cambodian Americans. And Andrew had heard about some of the work that we'd done. He'd come into the office because he is someone with a final order of removal against him. Well, a lot of the situations, circumstances that people like Andrew face are really related to their history of arrival and resettlement in the United States. And so few people understand the circumstances of Cambodian Americans and an understanding of the history, the political history of U.S. involvement in Cambodia and our, you know, history here in America. Which is very short-lived. Most Cambodians arrived during the 80s as part of the largest influx of refugees ever admitted into the United States. And very few people understand that. So, you know, the situation of Andrew is rather tragic because, you know, but for U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia, he might not have ever come to this country. Many thousands and thousands of Cambodians might not have ever come to this country. And oftentimes, when looking at sort of the criminalization of individuals, we forget to have an understanding of their history and a deeper sense of you know, the obstacles that they had to overcome to be here. And so, go ahead. Right. Sure. All right. Well, you know, Cambodia is situated between Laos and Vietnam in Southeast Asia and was a neutral state. However, it was drawn into the war because of its geography and troop movements of the Viet Cong through the Cambodian borders. And between 1968 and 1972, under the Nixon administration, an illegal bombing campaign was undertaken by the U.S. government to stop these troop movements. And what happened was that the U.S. government illicitly dropped tens of thousands of bombs and landmines across the Cambodian countryside. Now, this has been argued by a number of academics and scholars and historians that was one of the most significant factors towards the rise of the Khmer Rouge, who subsequently were responsible for the Cambodian genocide between 1975 and 1979. The anti-American sentiment from these bombings really increased the numbers of Khmer Rouge supporters. So that's one of the most significant things that the U.S. did specifically to sort of exasperate the situation in Cambodia. And what happened in 75, when the U.S. finally left the country, it was so unstable without that the Khmer Rouge actually just marched right into the capital and took over. And what we see over the next 4 years is one of the worst genocides in American history, where one out of every three people were killed or murdered. So it was quite devastating, and we're still recovering to this day. Right. What happened actually in 79, the Vietnamese actually invaded again. And there had been reports. One of the most frustrating things I think that many Cambodian Americans feel is that, you know, no one did anything. There was very little international response when all the killings were going on. And it actually took the invasion of the Vietnamese into Cambodia to usurp the Khmer Rouge, where we saw the greatest number of refugees fleeing to the border camps and leaving these, leaving the country and being able to seek refuge in places along the Thai border. And most Cambodians, you know, spent years in unsafe refugee camps before they were finally able to find sponsorship in countries like, you know, the United States, Australia, France. It was actually a very difficult thing. You know, oftentimes they were moved from these unsafe refugee camps and inserted directly into urban American poverty. And that's sort of, you know, part of Andrew's story is sort of understanding that, you know, he and his family had a very difficult situation, and they were taken from a refugee camp and really put into an impoverished situation where survival was difficult. And then you have U.S. policies that, you know, we think of being humanitarian focused, and I think that, of course, that's definitely part of it. But the other focus of, let's say, the creation of the Office of Refugee Resettlement in 1980, which was actually a direct response to this mass influx of Southeast Asian refugees, was you know, a very practical need to deal with these folks and make them employable and get them off of the welfare doles. And so employment has always been a primary focus of the refugee resettlement experience. And really, you know, in the early 80s, America, in dealing with this huge influx of refugees, was really learning for the first time how to deal with such a population. And a lot of the lessons learned on the backs of Cambodians and other Southeast Asians really never benefited the community. The need for holistic services, the need for mental health services, the need for social work and social services, you know, wasn't necessarily at the forefront, where there was an expectation that you would be able to get a job within 6 months. So you had a lot of parents leaving the homes to find work, leaving the kids with grandparents who spoke little or no English, the kids really having to figure things out for themselves in schools that, you know, were not the best schools and oftentimes not in the best neighborhoods. And so, you know, there was a lot of obstacles faced by folks like Andrew. I wouldn't say that there's a crime problem any more than you would say that, you know, that in poor communities there is crime, you know. But the question in looking at sort of Cambodians is, you know, what kind of circumstances and situations were they put into? And with connecting that with our history of arrival and resettlement, where there was little choice, there's little volitions in where you could choose to live, and there was little mobility, you know, that these kids had a lot going against them. So the choices were limited, their situations were limited, and they were put into areas where, you know, they needed to survive. And so, you know, they really had a lot of things that were challenging them. But to say that they specifically are prone to crime, that's not the case. I think that it's really more of a question of environment. Well, I mean, that's a really good question. And when you talk about demographics, one of the big challenges in dealing with the issues in our community is sort of the lack of understanding and statistical information that we have about our community. What we do have is sort of practical knowledge, practical experience, but in getting, let's say, information from the government about these demographics, actually asking, let's say, the Department of Homeland Security for what are these numbers? You know, what are the demographics? I mean, there are suspicions in our community that, you know, deportation is being utilized as a way of controlling gangs. And, you know, that is one of the fundamental problems that that many individuals have with the usage of immigration laws to sort of further be a extension of the criminal justice system, which they shouldn't be. There should be two separate things. Each and every one of these individuals who've committed crimes have paid their debt to society, have served their time, and just by virtue of where they were born are being treated separately or differently than if they were citizens. And when you look at refugees who arrived from a very early age, sometimes as young as 1 or 2 years old, what exactly is the difference? And, you know, what is the connection between, you know, your birth, where you were born, and recidivism? And so to talk about crime outside of this issue of recidivism, whether or not they're more likely to commit a crime, in my mind, makes no sense whatsoever. Well, that definitely, I mean, there definitely are a number of individuals I've worked with where theft has been an issue. Tragically, there's a number of folks that have crimes of violence like assaults and things like that. Thefts and robberies are some of them. But then there are some, you know, some really outrageous ones that and stories that you've probably read about in the newspapers of folks that have indecent exposure or, you know, things like that. That are also being in danger, put in danger of deportation. So,
when did the laws about deportation of non-citizens really start impacting the community?
Right. Right. Well, the laws were passed in 1996 and began to be implemented, you know, in 97. But the issue with Cambodians is that for many years was that of indefinite detention, and Cambodians became sort of the rallying cry of the poster children for this issue of indefinite detention, because Cambodia, prior to the agreement in 2002, was one of the few countries in the entire world distinguishing itself, you know, in that regard, that didn't accept deportees. And a lot of that was this history of genocide, and the fact that between 1975 and 1979, under the Khmer Rouge regime, the entire country was literally destroyed. I mean, that was one of the mottos of the regime, was to create a year zero, to turn the country back into an agrarian socialist state where folks were forced out of the cities and into the countryside to farm, where millions died from mass starvation and thousands were targeted for death because of their political background, their educational background, their religious beliefs, or their ethnic background. And the country, all documents were destroyed, birth records, school records, you know, bills, anything we sort of take for granted in modern society. So there's sort of no way to specifically identify these people as being Cambodian in any regard. So for many, many years, Cambodia said, you know, we've got no way to tell whether they are Cambodians. And so was one of the few countries in the world that that didn't recognize deportation. And so the situation arose where the 96 immigration laws required these folks that had committed crimes to be deported, but the country that they were to be deported to would not accept them. And so instead of being humane and letting people, out of detention, the U.S. government said, well, we can keep these people forever. And, many people spent years in INS, what they call detention facilities, that were in many ways just the same as being in jail. Many of them were, in many instances, they were contracted jails, and they were mingled with other inmates just as if they were still in prison, even though they had already, served their time. And many of these folks, had committed such minor offenses that they didn't even have to go to prison. So being in immigration detention was much worse than their initial punishment for their crime. And so in 2001, there was a Supreme Court case of two individuals. One was a Cambodian man named Kim Ho Ma, and one was a stateless person named Zed Vitus. And it was basically challenging the legality of the U.S. government's ability to detain people indefinitely. And when Kim Ho Ma went in front of the Supreme Court, it found that the INS was actually, at the time, the INS was actually acting illegally, and that it was unconstitutional to detain someone indefinitely if it wasn't foreseeable for them to be deported. So the result of this, this was before 9/11. This was, I think, in the summer of 2000, actually. So the result of this was basically to create like a big X mark on the foreheads of Cambodians, and really the response of the U.S. government was to pursue what they termed normalizations or negotiations with Cambodia in particular, to make these deportations come about, to make an agreement happen. And this went on over the course of the next year. So almost to the month of the anniversary of the Supreme Court case, you have a signed agreement with the country of Cambodia. And some of that was actually, one of the things that we know that the U.S. government did was to deny the visas of Cambodian nationals from traveling, so that folks from Cambodia couldn't travel to the United States directly, that they had to go to some third country, third-party country or something like that. But that was a very sort of big stick to really encourage the Cambodian government to do that. And I think also there was an agreement that that money would be paid per deportee to help with the processing. So that actually, my understanding is that the two incentives that the Cambodian government had to begin to accept deportations. Right. Well, there's no doubt that the taking away of children and being sent back to a country where they fled genocide, where a number of the perpetrators of the genocide still function in government, is very traumatizing to parents. For Cambodia, there's never been a Nuremberg. I mean, right now, actually, there's a Khmer Rouge tribunal that's in the process of being undertaken, but Cambodian Americans still view Cambodia in very they they didn't know what was going to happen to their children when they get deported. And so it was very traumatizing for parents and grandparents, and definitely a number of folks that my agency served were re-traumatized and needed mental health counseling because of events that were, the danger of deportation that were happening to their children. And that's actually very tragic. It feels, I mean, many folks have said to me that it feels just like Pol Pot all over again, you know, having the government take their children away. So it's a very traumatizing thing. I'm sorry, Robin, what was the second part of your question? Right. Well, it's always a very challenging thing, and this is something as an organizer and advocate that's one of the challenging things that we face is that the messaging around the issue of deportation, detention, and the criminalization that often is attached to it is very what's the term I'm looking for? It sort of breaks the community apart. It makes it more difficult because the issue is, is viewed a certain way, and people don't oftentimes want to deal with history and the past and making the connections that I spoke to you earlier about. And so it's easier to simply to vilify these individuals. And so from an organizing standpoint, it's been very challenging because the Cambodian American community, maybe because of its history and dealing with, its history and trauma from the Khmer Rouge, it has a difficult time organizing and standing up against the government, especially when the government might just be wrong, So it's a very challenging thing for the community overall to sort of wrap its head around the idea of detention, deportation, and their different ideas about it. And so that's one thing as socially that's sort of confronting the community is that there still needs to be a better sort of more education outreach, more understanding, a more willingness to sort of open, and deal with these skeletons in our closets regarding our past and our history, which to this day it haven't really been fully addressed. And this brings that right to our front door. So that's always challenging. And some people just don't want to hear it. They don't want to talk about genocide. They don't want to, look at these kids as genocide survivors. They'd rather just see them as villains and perpetrators of crimes and not the human beings that they really are. So, that's one of the big challenges. I think that you had talked a little bit before about the idea of the economic impact. I mean, a lot of these folks were the main breadwinners for the family. Many of these folks committed these crimes years ago. One of the things about the immigration laws is that it's retroactive. I mean, that's sort of like, what you need to understand about that is it's sort of basically changing the rules of the game in the middle of it. At the time that many of these guys committed their crimes, they weren't deportable offenses. In 96, the laws changed, so they became deportable offenses. And instead of taking kind of a fair view of that, the U.S. government said, well, we don't care. We're going to retroactively apply these laws and still make you deportable, even though you pled guilty to a crime that wasn't a deportable offense. Had you known that you were in danger of deportation, you might not have pled guilty to it. So subsequently, these guys have been living lives, they've learned their lessons, they paid their debt to society, they've been rehabilitated, they own businesses, they work for a living, they're taking care of wives and children, and all of a sudden, they go on a trip, they come back, and they're stopped at the border and told, oh, you've got this, this offense from 1987 or 89, and we're going to put you into removal proceedings. So it's been a very challenging thing economically on these families whose, you know, fathers oftentimes are being taken away, taken out of the household. So so many of these are the main breadwinners. Oh, sorry. Oh, sorry. Okay. Right. Well, I'm not the best person to talk to you specifically about that. I mean, I can tell you that that there has been a number of groups, and usually it's the young people, you know, youth groups who are sort of leading the charge and are willing to most stand up and saying this. And I think that that's, I mean, I think that that's really, that's really been a very positive thing, you know, as the, especially around, I mean, that a lot of that work came about around indefinite detention. And indefinite detention wasn't something that was geared towards specifically benefiting Cambodians. When Kim Ho Ma's case won in front of the Supreme Court, it wasn't just ending indefinite detention for Cambodians. It was ending indefinite detention for all immigrants, all non-citizens who were being detained unlawfully by the U.S. government. And so there was a wide coalition of groups, refugee groups, immigration groups, ethnic groups that were organizing and working with the Cambodian community to bring about an end to indefinite detention. And so that's one of the really good things that sort of happened is that Cambodians were suddenly the center of focus, and a lot of people were really interested in mobilizing the community. But then what we had happen after the Ma case, you know, was sort of this really strange sort of response where after deportation started to occur, when the agreement was signed and everything like that, people had this feeling that we couldn't advocate strongly about one community, that it's not fair to talk about ending deportations of just Cambodians if people from Guatemala or Honduras or other really terrible places are being deported back as well. And so that's a really challenging thing, because a number of the organizing efforts that came out of the indefinite detention movement that was focused on Cambodians after Cambodians were actually being indicted, you know, the response to the U.S. government, that these groups weren't so interested in specifically advocating on behalf of Cambodians. And that's been one of the real challenging things. So now we're trying to figure out, like, how do we move forward now? What can we do? And how do we work in, you know, within these larger groups, these larger coalitions? How do Cambodian Americans mobilize? And I think that that's still a question that needs to be addressed. Ryan. Right. Well, I want to definitely say that that's definitely one of the cases that there's been, you know, after the 96 immigration laws and things like that, there were a lot of resources that were put around naturalization and citizenship and those things. And so we've seen, you know, my own agency had a successful citizenship and naturalization project, and we're you know, we're very happy to do that, but that really doesn't sort of underpine the real, I mean, the context for this, that you know, it's great to encourage naturalization and citizenship, but not at the expense, not out of the fear of these deportations, and the consequences are simply not fair. You know, a number of these kids came at such an early age. The reasons why they aren't citizens was because of their parents' inability to become citizens. These are folks that suffered through mass starvation, that were highly traumatized, that were called to be sort of farmers and told not to learn by a regime that murdered you if you were educated whatsoever. And they were expected to come to America and learn history and learn how to read and write when many of these folks didn't know how to read and write in Cambodian. And so these are the parents of these kids that were expected to naturalize. And had these parents naturalized, these kids would probably be citizens to this day and wouldn't be in danger of deportation. So, you know, we continue to encourage naturalization and citizenship, but we want people to understand, you know, that that doesn't answer this problem. That's not what this is about. You know, this isn't, you know, a complete lack of an understanding of the community that has special needs, that deserves to be recognized and not be tossed aside by immigration laws that are overbroad and overly harsh. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, I think that you need specifically to be able to look at his circumstances, which number of his crimes were actually deportable offenses. And I don't think that you can sort of lump them all together and to say because he committed, you know, some misdemeanors and things like that. You know, basically, with our immigration laws, it's one strike, you're out. You know, so it's not that he's so much a repeat offender. It doesn't matter, you know, the fact that it doesn't take one crime, it doesn't take two crimes or three crimes or four crimes, it only takes one crime, is the way the immigration laws work. So it's not really about recidivism in that regard at all. And again, I'm going to say this again, that there's no connection between a person's birthplace, you know, especially if they arrived here as a very small child and grew up here and is a product of American society, and their likelihood to commit a crime. And I think that Andrew's situation is no different, that I don't think that he's any more or less likely to commit a crime than a person that was born here. And so I question the legitimacy of saying that he's undeserving, because it's simply not fair. It's like saying, you know, that we're going to treat you differently for the color of your skin. And I don't think that people make that connection at all. Right. Okay, let me make an effort at that. Well, I mean, yeah, I think that looking at sort of U.S. policies and understanding, you know, that during the 70s, and, you know, there was a real outpouring of kindness and recognizing that, you know, U.S. involvement in Vietnam, Southeast Asia, was a no-win situation, and the U.S. sort of withdrawal from those countries, you know, led to this sort of vacuum, and there was a recognizing of the need to sort of humanitarian aid and the need to sort of make amends for the things that happened in Southeast Asia, and that there were really promises that were made, you know, to those groups. There are many Cambodians fought with CIA, worked, with the military, U.S. military, and supported, U.S. efforts. And coming to America, was in many ways, this massive resettlement that we see of Southeast Asians throughout the 80s was sort of a recognition of those contributions, made by Southeast Asians, Vietnamese Americans, Laotians, Cambodians, and all the different ethnic minorities from those countries. And, however, it was a little schizophrenic because, as I mentioned to you, that, the creation of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, wasn't necessarily just about sort of humanitarian resettlement. There were very specific expectations that ORR would was basically also to be an employment agency to get these folks employable in a short period of time. And so, the American dream is about sort of making your way. But for many of these folks, it was sort of sink or swim. And what we see with sort of the deportations of these young people, these children, upon arrival, is really sort of the, maybe can be argued the the effects of really short-sighted resettlement policies. And, the question of, when you're taken out of an unsafe refugee camp and inserted to American poverty, where it's not uncommon to share the mattress on the floor, with, in a two-bedroom apartment with, 10 to 15 people. What real opportunities do you have? When you're hungry all the time and you're impoverished, how well can you learn? And so, I would say, when did people sort of wake up to realizing that the American dream might not necessarily be for them? Almost immediately. Well, I think that it's sort of, it's really very much that we don't care about you. It's that, this is about, in many ways, and what the laws that out of 1996, was targeted at, it wasn't just immigration, but welfare reform. All this came out together, and there was this sense at that time, this real, that the blame for, our welfare ills was on non-citizens, on immigrants. So the immigration laws, these horrible deportation laws, went hand in hand with this restructuring of the welfare state, the welfare system, and the elimination of benefits and things, and Medicare and health to immigrants went hand in hand with their deportations. And it was a clear, looking at sort of the retroactivity and the lack of judicial oversight, that America was telling the immigrants that we don't care about you and that we blame you for our welfare ills. And so, which we know is to be completely false, is that we know that immigrants actually benefit America. We work and we own businesses and we buy homes and all those sort of ideas or misconceptions were the basis of these anti-immigrant and horrible immigration and welfare laws. So the message is that we don't care about you and we'd rather use you as an excuse than really understand you. Well, I know that there's been a lot of, I know that there's been a lot of efforts made. There in Cambodia, there's one project. It was called the Returning Assistance Project. And subsequently, within the past few weeks, actually, USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, has announced about $800,000 that's going to go towards the resettlement of deportees, and hopefully better acculturate or allow them to assimilate into the Cambodian community. So, the U.S. I understand that that's what's happening with this $800,000 grant that USAID is doing. There was an article about that in the Cambodian Daily, I think. So. Well, one of the things is that there's a real big movement to look at refugees, and hopefully sort of say that, if you arrived here as a small child as a refugee, then in, many regards, you should be treated as a citizen for all intents and purposes when it comes to deportation. But it's really hard to say with everything that's going around on the Hill right now whether or not there's going to be any traction about it. But there's the Khmer Rouge tribunals that you should definitely be sort of aware about. That's going to have an impact on policies, and that's actually going on right now, that they've been organizing around that. And there have been recent articles in Journal of American Medicine and other places that talks about the ongoing traumas of mental health and health issues that Cambodian Americans face. So we're hoping, one of my other hats is that I'm a committee member of the National Cambodian American Health Initiative, and we're really working on trying to have hearings around Cambodian American health issues to get people to have a better understanding of the challenges that our communities face when it comes to health and how this relates to our socioeconomic and economic situation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That was a lot of information.
Right. Well, I hope it was helpful.
Yeah, I really appreciate you driving down and accommodating the schedule.
No, no problem. No, it's all right. It's quite all right. I look forward to hearing, seeing it come out in May, and let me know if there's any kind of follow up that you need. We can correspond, or if any way I can help you with developing the story. And if there's anything specific about Andrew, I could definitely beef that up more, because he's just an amazing guy, an incredibly spiritual guy, definitely a guy who's turned his life around and doesn't deserve to be sent back at all. He's just one of those really amazing guys that can just, become something wonderful if given the opportunity. So I'm just really, really hoping that that things will work out for him.
Well,
it was really interesting, because I think that the fact that, when he first came to our agency, I didn't know. I mean, there aren't that many. My agency, Cambodia Community Development, in Oakland, is the only Cambodian, not the only Cambodian serving agency, but the only Cambodian led ethnic based organization in the Bay Area. And when he came to our community, he really didn't know that much about sort of the work or social or nonprofit work. And to see him sort of learn about issues, read up on the immigration laws, learn about his situation, learn about citizenship and naturalization, and teach other people about it, and speak up and speak out about, the dangers and the need for naturalization, and see him sort of empower himself, was just really amazing over the course of the time I spent with him, almost a year. And it became more, he became more and more interested in just sort of standing up and doing what he could, you know, to make sure that other people, you know, were made aware. And and so I mean that's been one of the amazing things about him. And he's, you know, he's given so much time, and you know, he went above and beyond, you know, to work and support our agency. So, you know, I'd like to support him any way I can.